can invite all of the speakers back up to the front. We'll have sort of 20 minutes or so for questions, and then that's time for everybody to put their makeup on before the welcome reception. Just while people are coming up, I'd just like to sort of ask Meg, do you really think that it's practicable that we're going to reduce the prevalence rates using preventative strategies that may also increase survival, so ACE inhibitors reducing the risk of death, and also the fact that it's not a level playing field? You know, we're looking at a warming world with heat stress and sort of extension like the Mesoamerican situation.
I could take the easy answer and say I think we're going to reduce age prevalent rates. You are right, there are some factors that are moving the wrong way, and the lifestyle factors are an example, and that's going to be particularly a problem for the developing world where there's the most trajectory in increase in hypertension, sedentary behaviour and diabetes. So yes, there are factors working against us.
Okay. Would anyone like to ask any questions of the panel?
To David. David, do you think... I'm up here.
That sounds like Winchester. There he is.
David, I was thinking about your oxalate-forming, the oxalate-destroying bacteria.
Yep.
Any chance that you've thought about fecal transplantation to people who are OF negative?
Of course I have. I want to do that. I'm negative, right? I'm looking for a donor. So, Jim, it's a serious conversation. In fact, we are doing studies of the, you know, I work with Marty Blazer at NYU, who's the director of the Microbiome Institute, and Marty thinks quite a lot about fecal transplant for particularly obesity, which is, you know, very likely to work. There's a lot of good animal data on that. And so the question of whether Oxalobacter can be administered as an oral agent, make it to the colon where it likes to live, and then find the conditions under which it would, you know, flourish, is not completely clear. One of the hard things about all of the Oxalobacter data is that in order to maintain the colony, you want to feed it the bad thing, which is oxalate. Are you better off being on a low oxalate diet, or are you better off having Oxalobacter, which metabolizes the oxalate that you eat? It's not completely clear to me. And I could show both sides of that question. So, like, as an example, in rats, you have to feed them oxalate in order to maintain their colonization status. So I think this is relatively complicated. It's also likely that there are other organisms that degrade oxalate. We have some data that's not published that E. coli degrades more oxalate than other organisms, but Oxalobacter is the champion oxalate degrader, but there's more E. coli. So it's possible that we need to encourage a community of appropriate, community of bacteria, and that is not completely clear. But we certainly talk about what you've suggested.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we've got a number of written questions down, sort of for Dr. Kwan and Ravi, really, which is thinking about albumin. Obviously, the role of the synthetic colloid has been largely discredited, but what about albumin in terms of mobilizing edema and as a fluid compared to some of the crystalloids?
Yeah, this is a frequently asked question. Actually, albumin in the blood circulation, albumin concentration is, we always teach the fellows, this is a negative inflammatory indicator. What happens is when patient develops some sort of infection, there is an acute vasodilation, compromise in the barrier layer. Actually, the albumin is still in the body, but extravasated into the interstitium. So you want the interstitium lymphatic to continuously flow so that albumin will return to the circulation via lymphatic thoracic duct. So from a therapeutic standpoint, actually, during the vascular leakage type of a situation, the more albumin you give, it doesn't last long. Usually I say 45 or less than in a couple of hours, it completely extravasated into the interstitium. What it happened is you left you with more interstitium congestion, and it actually it doesn't help with the overall volume status. Maybe short in a very short period, but it doesn't last long.
So just to follow up on that, what has been effective, though, is that if you utilize albumin in hypoalbuminemic patients, if you use 25 grams of albumin and follow it with a diuretic, if they're diuretic responsive, or with dialysis for ultrafiltration, you do see an improvement in both hemodynamic stability and also improvement in the ability to remove fluid. So we actually have an ongoing study right now looking at using 25 grams of albumin at the start of dialysis to see if we can influence fluid removal rates. And what we're looking at is both Chris's protocol of cardiac echoes, but we're also looking at microcirculation and sublingual microcirculation under the tongue. And so this is an ongoing study, and hope to we'll be able to present some of that data in the near future.
I think the microcirculation over the tongue is very, very important because it gives us an evidence in the microcirculatory level whether to acutely expand the volume via albumin support in certain population might be helpful. But in the patient with like a septic sepsis, septic shock setting, there is no study demonstrate any benefits.
I suppose the challenge is all colloids are water eventually. It's just a question of how long it takes. I mean, albumin takes about, 8 to 10 hours to get there. But, you know, they all end up there eventually. Yeah. Ravi, I was very interested in the data looking at anemia as a risk factor in acute kidney injury. I wonder if you had any thoughts about the emerging role that erythrocytes aren't dumb. They're actually smart, and they respond to tissue hypoxia, and they direct flow. And do you think there's any part, not only of the level of anemia, but of the population and the relative intelligence of the erythrocytes that we have in our circulations?
So that's a loaded question, but to preface my response to it, in addition to anemia being as a risk factor for development of acute kidney injury, we've been looking at anemia as a risk factor for recovery from acute kidney injury. And what we find is actually it has got a very strong signal with respect to recovery also. So if you take a cutoff of 9 grams of hemoglobin and you took quartiles below and above and you took the whole population, we've done this both in the Picard study cohort but also in a prospective cohort looking at our UCSD data, we find there's a very strong signal with almost a threefold increased risk of non-recovery if you are anemic. So with respect to whether or not this is a signal from which is from erythrocytes or doing other things, I don't know that it is easy to tease out, given that so many factors go into both iron metabolism versus the management of, you know, various factors such as erythropoietin in terms of the bone marrow response. So I don't have an answer to that, but I think it's an area which has been relatively not tested or thought about as constant.
So the role of transfusion is controversial, isn't it?
Yes.
Are all hemoglobin levels the same regardless of how we actually chose to get them there?
That's correct. So I think that the other thing in terms of transfusion associated things is that the evidence comes up in terms of, and this gets into the microcirculatory aspect, is if you look at any fluid which is being given, as Dr. Kwan pointed out, is the endothelial glycocalyx becomes the integral layer which determines where the fluid will be and how long it will stay. So when you give fluid, you're causing swelling everywhere. And so you're changing the diffusion distance that oxygen has to travel across to get to tissue. If you give blood, the oxygen-carrying capacity goes up, and so the diffusion distance is less. And that kind of becomes part of the issue of blood transfusions being both effective, but then they have downsides too.
Sorry, Dr. Finkelstein, waiting patiently there.
No, Chris. I'd like to just go back. We're fortunate to have people on the podium from all over the world. So when you look at high-income countries, going back to the last talk, One thing that's puzzled me is why the incidence of end-stage renal disease is so much lower in countries such as Europe and Australia than there would be in the U.S., for example, or Japan. And as you pointed out, in the elderly population, where the incidence continues to rise, sort of in the U.S. and Japan, it's not in European countries. So what's going on here is that ESRD care is not being offered to elderly people. They've developed supportive care programs. And how do you see that evolving over time? But there are people from Europe, from the UK, from Brazil, from Australia. I'd be curious how you comment on this.
Yes, thanks. Look, it's a great question. Certainly, it appears that the incidence plateauing in those countries is the incidence of renal replacement therapy, not of end stage. Because of the nature of dialysis registries, our knowledge of undialyzed end stage is much weaker. But there have been studies in Australia that estimate there's at least one elderly person with untreated end stage for everyone that's treated. So it does appear that the threshold for dialysing elderly patients with end stage is different in countries like the US and Singapore and Taiwan than it is in Europe and Australia and Canada, for that matter.
Right. So maybe, Chris, what goes on in the UK? Because you have to assume the incidence could be the same. It's not going to be different. Just look at Caucasians in the US compared to the UK or Australia.
Yes, I think you're right. I think the likelihood is that the incidence of end stage is the same, and what's differing is people being offered and or taking up dialysis.
Yeah, so
I think that's the difference.
Why would the incidence be so much lower in Australia or the UK or Brazil, for example, in the US? Is that care is not offered? They have supportive care programs, but what do you think is happening?
But if you strim it all down, it often comes out to billing practices, doesn't it?
Well, there's a lot of factors, I think, going on. Yeah. One is that there is a lot of interest in supportive care programs, initially in the UK and now more recently in Australia. We are dialysing people at lower eGFRs. I can see the Canadians are struggling to implement a guideline to get people not starting dialysis before an eGFR of 12. In Australia, our average eGFR would be around 7 now, particularly post-ideal. So there's a whole group of people who are being dialysed that while they're progressing down to 7. And, of course, in that time, if another event happens, if you have a fatal event, then you're not going to appear in the registry in Australia, whereas you would if you were in the US. So I think there's dialysing at a different thresholds for offering. There are certain conditions that appear to be dialysed more often in, like there's a recent paper from Canada showing that quite a lot of people with aggressive metastatic and hematological malignancies are being offered dialysis, and I don't think that would happen in Australia so much. I don't know, maybe others would care to comment.
Well, Meg, you shown a very nice relationship in terms of life expectancy and renal replacement therapy. So do you think that part of what Fred is asking is related to if in Nepal or in India or in Cambodia the life expectancy is only 70 years, do people just don't have an opportunity to get dialysis?
Don't live long enough to develop end stage. That's definitely a factor. Globally, that's a very strong factor, and life expectancy and gross national income do travel together. But I think you're talking about even amongst the high-income countries, why is there that discrepancy in practice?
Just the high-income countries, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there has to be a different... you go back and you talk about equitable access, and I'm curious how you would think of it. You could think of it in terms of low, middle-income countries compared to high-income countries. But even, of course, high-income countries, there is not equitable access for reasons that need to be clarified, I think. Don't you?
Yeah, look, I think that's a great question. And the thing that we really don't know is the group of people who don't benefit from dialysis. I think there's no equipoise at all with the young person. There's, someone who you knew was a day from death. I think everyone would agree they're not going to benefit from dialysis. Somewhere in there's a group for whom there is true equipoise about whether dialysis is a positive or a negative or a neutral thing. But it's very hard to tease out who that population is, and I think it'd be harder still to conduct a trial. Well,
that's very slippery because it depends. Is that in the eyes of the beholder? Is that in the eyes of the caregiver or the eyes of the individual patient?
Look, how you define benefit, yes, even defining benefit is an issue. How you define harm. So we don't like to grapple with that so much, of course. It's an uncomfortable feeling. But I think all of us have treated patients where we look back and say, in retrospect, that patient did not benefit. Sometimes we hasten their death. It's very hard to know in advance.
Next question.
I have two questions for Dr. Goldfarb. You suggested a similar trend between coronary artery disease and nephrolithiasis. Did you look at uric acid as a risk factor for both of those?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's very important because uric acid, certainly, you know, at NYU is one of the gout uric acid capitals. So I think that's a terrific idea. In those NHANES data and the other studies demonstrating that people, and it's interesting that two of the largest studies showed this effect in women and not in men, they did not have those kinds of data. But I think that's a great hypothesis. There's no question that uric acid hyperuricemia is associated with kidney stones, and that's not clear exactly why that should be. That's not necessarily uric acid stones. It could be that your patients with gout are also at risk for calcium stones. And as you suggest, there's pretty good data that uric acid is associated with coronary disease, some studies suggesting that allopurinol prevents myocardial infarction and even kidney outcomes as well. So I like your hypothesis.
My second question, which I'd like your comment on, is that in my stone clinic, I see an association between osteoporosis in female patients and kidney stones. My question to you is, am I missing a form thrust of renal tubular acidosis where the acidifying defect causes mobilization of calcium from bone to buffer the acidosis?
Probably not. I mean, I think that your observation is supported by lots of good epidemiologic data demonstrating that people with calcium stones, and particularly people with hypercalciuria, have decreased bone density. So the two hypotheses are, one, that this is actually a bone disease with increased bone turnover leading to loss of calcium. The kidney, an innocent bystander, is affected and winds up with kidney stones. Another possibility is that, for instance, claudin mutations lead to calcium leak that would lead to decreased bone density as well. So, for instance, claudin 14, which is expressed in the tight junction of the thick ascending limb, was shown to be responsible for 25% of hypercalciuria in Iceland. When they looked at those patients' bone density where they had those data, most of those patients also had decreased bone density compared to a control group. So I think there are a lot of different possibilities there. However, I would also say that with respect to our acidosis, if you give patients with kidney stones, calcium stones or uric acid stones, if you give them potassium citrate, of course, is good for bone density. So it prevents kidney stones and it increases bone mineral density. So it's an appropriate therapy. And you would not be able to distinguish that from patients who actually had some even subtle urinary acidification defect. So I like your question, Stuart.
So we've got two written back-to-back questions, a bit ICU-based. The first is about the choice of PD fluid to use in the acute setting and whether or not you had any experience using icodextrin in that setting, particularly for the ones with volume overload as the principal indication.
About the PD fluid?
Yes.
The calcium. There's two studies that evaluate different fluids of PD, and for septic patients, the guidelines of ASPD suggest, if it's possible, to use bicarbonate as a buffer and not lactate. But for example, in Brazil, there isn't dialysate using bicarbonate, so we use lactate.
And then the other one really is sort of an emotion intelligence one. I like this one. It's clearly written by somebody who's angry. Patients with septic shock in the ICU, hemodynamics improve, but the intensivists just keep giving fluids. Do you have any experience, and how do you deal with that? I think I'll open that up to everybody on the panel. What do you do with an intensivist who just won't be told?
I've been doing the intensive care nephrologist for the last almost 20 years in Mayo Clinic, and I see all sorts of that kind of circumstances. Some extreme cases, patient mounted more than 20 liters of fluids, causing compartment syndrome. Fasciotomy has to be done because of the volume overload. Still, the mindset is very hard to change. What my approach would you know, I think it's a baby step, but small steps, which is to increase communication. You know, going back again, I go to the surgery department, give them a talk about the AKI and the fluids. Recently, also with a vet patient, the assisted device patients, again, there's a huge motivation to give lots of fluids. And I think we are gradually winning the cardiovascular intensivist and saying, look, the fluids could be very detrimental. There's a window period. So I don't have a good answer, but I think we need to communicate with the different peoples more.
Can we not ask that nice Mr. Trump just to write an executive order? Wouldn't that do it? Seems to be the best way to get anything done.
I think there's two other aspects, and some of it is obviously is improved communication, which means that we've got to round with the intensivists on an ongoing basis and not only when we are consulted, and we need to understand their point of view as to why they're giving the fluids. And if you think about it, the easiest way to manage hypotension is start a fluid drip. And then the next easiest is start a vasopressor drip. And then you can think about other inotropes. You've got inotropes, vasopressors, and fluids is your three options to manage any hypotensive patient. And it depends upon what the intensivist is thinking about in terms of how they would approach each of these elements there. I think offering them the option is okay. If you want to give fluids, give us the opportunity to remove them. So in that context, I think that part of this is if you've already seen somebody who's 20 liters ahead, there's no point in trying to have a diuretic drip to try and get their urine output up to about 2 liters when you're not going to be able to manage their need of 4 liters of fluid coming in from drugs and everything else. I think that's where you're thinking of initiating therapy with CRRT or whatever modality you think of as a adjunct to it. So that's one part.
Ravi, the part I don't, also don't understand, though, in that regard, is there isn't an alternative literature that none of us know. There's not some papers out there that are suggesting that the pulmonologists have demonstrated that giving volume is useful. That's the part I don't get. And their pulmonology literature has progressively shown that volume is bad for pulmonary outcomes, right?
Yes.
So that's the other part that I always have a hard time with. They don't have something to hand you and say, here's the paper that came out last week in CHEST.
No. Absolutely
it doesn't
not.
Exist, right?
No, no, I think you're absolutely right. And I think part of this is also for them to, and when you say them and us, I don't think it should be them and us. It should be we together, which I think is the key element here. Is we are ultimately responsible for improving outcomes as a team, not necessarily as an opponent on two different viewpoints of doing things. And I think that's part of the thing is the relationship often becomes adversarial. It's saying, you're not going to listen to me, so I'm just going to back off and not come and chat with you. That, I think, that sets into motion a lot of these aspects there. But assuming you do have good communication and you're able to relate to them, I think part of the strategy here might be saying is, give us a trial of therapy approach for whatever we have best to offer you, and then let us manage that aspect with you. And I think that often gets into at least some dialogue. I make one last point, and I think this is, I'd like to ask the audience, is in your minds, when you see a patient and you come across this concept of pre-renal, whatever your individual concept of pre-renal is, how often is your first response, give fluid? If I could have a raise of hand of how many people have that first response, pre-renal means fluid.
Jim, put your hand down.
Okay? So I think this is part of our own culture in the nephrology side. We see the word pre-renal, it means fluid. So if we as nephrologists feel like that, most of our colleagues who are not in the nephrology field are going to see even more of that. Instead of saying is the kidney needs fluid. And then they say, the intravascular compartment is constricted because everything is outside, so give fluid. And that sort of becomes the self-fulfilling prophecy. They say 500 bolus, then 100 cc's an hour for the next 24 hours. And pretty much you're able to now reflect why they go down that pathway. Because it's the easiest way to think about it.
So I think if we finish the session then, we can all go away and reflect on how we've enabled complex belief systems to replace medical knowledge and feel slightly ashamed of ourselves. But on that, I thought it was an excellent session. I'd like to thank all of the speakers one more time.